Hi, I'm Lori Hennessy, and this is Washington Game Changers, a podcast that we put on here at League of Education Voters to talk about people who are doing good in the community. And my guest today is a perfect definition of someone who's done good in the community, Frank Abe. Hello.
Lori.
Hi. I'm going to let folks hear from you about your history and what you've done because there's so many great stories to tell. And I have to warn everyone, it's going to be hard to do all this in my 30 minutes. So I'm going to have to fight my instincts to go long. As Frank and I have known each other for 35 years, you are probably
That
one of
long,
my,
huh?
yeah,
Wow.
one of my first bosses. So this is very exciting to be talking to you today. So let's
I was never
start.
your boss. I was only your co.
Okay,
Let's
sorry.
get straight right now. This is
He
going to be
was my
great.
coworker. So let's start with the Day of Remembrance. If you could tell us a little bit about the Day of Remembrance, I think it's relatively known now by people, but you were very critical to this becoming an event. So tell us about that first, if you can.
I should preface it by saying I've been very involved with Japanese American incarceration history for 45 years. And the Day of Remembrance was something that we created here in Seattle, 1978, November. And it's become an invented tradition ever since where Americans live. It's an act of reclaiming our history from those who minimized or denied the existence of incarceration. Back in the thing called Hot Talk Radio, whenever the subject of the wartime incarceration of Japanese Americans came up, people would phone in to stations that would deny that the camps that held 120,000 Japanese Americans were to evicted from them solely on the basis of race after the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor. They were bad, that they were for our own benefit, that a lot of good came out of it, a lot of educational opportunity. And so around this time also, Lori, in the 70s, my generation came of age, and we did not accept the that the wartime incarceration, once we left, which we didn't learn about it in school. We rejected the idea that it was voluntary. We were well fed, aided, and free, proved our loyalty. So began to talk to our parents' generation about the injustice, constitutional violations, the lack of due process, the denial of equal protection under the law as guaranteed in the Constitution. Out of that came the idea of redress and reparations. I should add that the concept of redress was generated not by my generation, but the second generation Japanese Americans, my parents' generation. They knew it was wrong, but it took 35, 40 years for them to speak up about it. They wanted to make a stand for redress. And I was recruited to help them create the first event here in Seattle. It was our caravan from Stadium, the old 16 in Rainier Valley, the Puyallup Fairgrounds, where I grew up in Puyallup. And it was a commemoration, a day of remembrance. It was a very kind of family-oriented event. But the subtext was, remember the concentration camps, stand for redress with your family, just to begin to talk about it. A friend of mine, Frank Chin, had the idea. Henry Miyatake got the Seattle JCL chapter behind it, and I helped organize and promote it. And we did, and I helped get some stories in newspapers, interviews. And we showed up on the day, November 25th, Thanksgiving weekend, 1978, and 2,000 people showed up at Sick's Stadium. This is like the biggest gathering of Japanese Americans in Seattle since World War II. And we were stunned. But it was a long, miles-long car caravan down Interstate 5 to Puyallup, where we held potluck lunch and a talent show, and got major media, Seattle Times front page, King TV, all the TV stations were there, and it lit a spark across the nation for the redress campaign to be taken seriously. Now that was Thanksgiving weekend because that was the time we had. It's become a commemoration of February 19th, 1942, which was when our President Franklin Roosevelt signed an executive order, 9066, to authorize the mass exclusion of Japanese Americans from the West Coast after World War II, after Pearl Harbor. And so now that is, as I say, an invented tradition wherever Japanese Americans live in the U.S. Observed every year, and this year is the 80th anniversary of EO 906-6. And so we'll be speaking. My co-author Tomiko Nomura and I, we'll talk about that later, we'll be speaking virtually the Mukai Farm and Garden, doing a Vashon Island Day of Remembrance, February 19th, 2022, at 4 p.m. Local time.
Oh, there's so many things I want to talk about. So first of all, you mentioned Puyallup. So I grew up in Puyallup, and we never learned about any of this.
Of course. No, that's not a surprise.
Yeah, and I remember you actually were the person, thank you very much, who let me know about the history of the Puyallup fairgrounds. It feels as if any progress that has been made as a society towards perhaps teaching our full history, whether it's the history around Black Americans or history around internment, it feels like much of that is under assault right now, because there are plenty of people who would just rather have a pristine view.
Well, they want to burn the books, Lori. Let's just be out, come out and say it. I mean, this critical race theory nonsense is so such a cynical attack on not you know, intellectualism or you know, a field of study. It's an attack on history. It's an attack on simply teaching the facts of history. Mm-hmm. It's the most frustrating thing I can imagine, because it's not even, well, the critical theory, as I understand it, is simply a wedge issue cooked up in a right-wing think tank funded by our friends, the Koch brothers, late in, what, before the last election in 2020.
Yeah.
As an attack on political candidates, as a wedge issue, and as an organizing tool for the right wing, you know, news media spaces.
Yeah.
And within the space of just 1 year, Lori, as your previous guest pointed out in an earlier podcast, I mean, this is into law in states. Even in Iowa, I saw that federal a felony prosecution in prison has been advocated for teachers who assign books with LGBTQ themes. So this thing is spreading. And the goal is to instill fear, to make educators need to teach the mere facts of American history, much less any activism or thought. So we need to just identify for what it is. And it's up to, you know, us as parents, as citizens, to stand up to it.
Yeah. You mentioned Vashon, and by the way, I had a little bit of you froze a little bit there. So I'm hoping that was my Wi-Fi and we don't lose
the connection. No, it's probably me. Yeah.
Okay. All right. I'm going to move so my Wi-Fi has a better signal. This is what you call being adaptable when you're on video. You mentioned Vashon, which is where I'm speaking to you from, and Mukai Farm. Tell us more about that event, because I would love to do anything I can to kind of promote that event that you have on the 19th.
Well, we wanted to do it at the Vashon Center for the Art with the Omicron fears, peaking now. It looks like the idea was to do it. It's going to be virtual online. Yeah. So we'll talk to folks online. But the local angle, of course, is what we learned from Day of Exile that you had on Vashon, was that you had 11 Vashon residents who were hurt by trucks in May of 1942, May 16th, 1942. They were hurt under trucks at downtown. They were sent to detention camps at Aindale, the assembly center, which is notable for me because that was one of the camps that fed into the 2 week war relocation center, which was then converted into this 2 week segregation center. Is a story that we address in our graphic novel, which I'll just quickly show you the cover. We hereby refuse.
Nice.
Yeah, which is blurred out. On video is blurred out. But we have a graphic novel, We Hereby Refused, Japanese-American Resistance to Wartime Incarceration, written by myself and Tomoko Nimura of Tacoma, and artwork by Ross Ishikawa and Matt Sasaki of Seattle, Chin Music Press, published last year. And so we'll be talking about the graphic novel in connection with the Vashon exclusion.
Tell me more about the novel. It's gotten quite the buzz. A lot of my friends have mentioned it.
I appreciate that. And that's the book has found its audience. And, you know, I'd like to think it's on the strength of the artwork and the story, which takes an unflinching look at the not only the government's actions to target American minority based solely on race, but also an unflinching look at my own community's response to advocate in some parts collaboration, cooperation with the government in order to secure better treatment in the camps and to win acceptance from the white majority after the war. There are things that and agitating about in my community for the last 40 years, making myself not a popular figure in some of the Japanese American community. I was glad to get it in the novel to give a very thick and well-rounded story of resistance to incarceration, resistance to both the government and to our own internal collaborators and cooperators.
Yeah. Tell me about, and I'm thinking, I still keep having us freeze a little bit as we're talking. So since the vast majority of people that follow this podcast do so on radio, I'm hoping if we both kill our video now, then there'll be a little bit less freezing of the sound. Do you want to try that so we can keep talking?
My video stopped. Yeah.
All right. I'm going to stop mine too. Sorry to tell you. All right. So let's see if that helps with the sound. Tell me about, you know, when I met you, we worked at Cairo Radio, and I remember that you had a feature series you did that was called Other Voices. And I loved that. I remember that's something we spent a lot of time talking about. And in it, you told a lot of stories of the voices in our community that we often don't hear. I'm just wondering about at that time period in the early 80s, mid 80s, that seems like it was pretty bold for you to be able to do that. How did you get support for that?
It was a necessity under the FCC at the time that, you know, TV and radio broadcasters devote a certain percentage of time to minority communities. So Cairo at the time had a minority report. Mm-hmm. And when I was fortunate to be air after a couple of years, not as your boss, but as your coworker, to go air, Vic Bremer, our wonderful, wonderful news and program director, who I hope is listening, asked me to take on the Minority Report, which was at the time, you know, kind of a straightforward, you know, diversity. Of course, the word diversity didn't exist then. You know, an attempt at affirmative action, let's put it that way.
Yeah.
Talk very safe. You know, affirmative action officers at banks and corporations. When I got it, it was just this wonderful opportunity to interview people that I wanted to meet, authors, filmmakers, act in the community. And so I just sought out people like Louise Erdrich, a Native American novelist, Spike Lee, before he became famous, African American artist Jacob Lawrence went to his studio and talked to him there.
Wow!
Oh, I know. I mean, these great opportunities to meet people and explore their stories on the radio, and the series found an audience because it thought into it and. The characters, the personalities were, as you say, the ones who were not covered by Cairo mm-hmm. mainstream news at the time, and wow. still not, quite frankly. Yeah. But I put some thought into the scripts and the editing. After a year or so, I said, "Why am I calling this a minority report? I got to find some other way to, to own it better." So, Other Voices became the title for that. And even now, I look back on the title Other Voices, and I realize I was marginalized. Even then, I was marginalizing other. You know, we were the other, but that was honest. I mean, that we were the other at the time, and it is fear of the other that drives critical race theory, for example, and fear of the other that I was trying to overcome with mm-hmm. the series. So, you know, for the time, it was an adequate title.
Yeah,
but but it did. You know, I did it at the expense of my free time and some spot news coverage, perhaps. But I had this, but Vic and Andy loved it. They it went from a Saturday morning time slot to add a Friday afternoon drive time spot because it was so well liked.
I remember when we were in the newsroom and Gordon Hirabayashi, who, you know, became a very, you know, as well known as you can get for someone taking a stand on issues around internment, I guess, in Washington State. And I remember that was a breaking story and you were in the newsroom one day. And at the time I was part-time student at UW and then working at Cairo. And I remember you said, Gordon Hirabayashi is a person who is protesting what happened to him when he was at UW and there's a trial and you would be very interested in that trial. And I ended up coming down to the trial and like following it and throughout the rest of Gordon's life as he continued to get a lot of acclaim for taking the stand he did. I always remembered this feeling of chagrin that when I came and heard from Gordon at that trial, it was the first time I'd ever heard of internment. And and that would have been when I was, 22 years old. Wow. Sort of a shameful story to share, but he was such a hero to me. And so thank you.
It's not shameful. I hear this a lot. It's not shameful, Lori, because you weren't exposed to this in school. It's this responsibility of your educators, not of yourself. But I'm glad you came down to the federal courthouse, to the courtroom of federal judge Donald Voorhees, if I recall. Right?
Yep.
And you saw Gordon take the stand it was an evidentiary hearing on his writ of error coram nobis to vacate his ward Supreme Court conviction for violating the exclusion order, the initial exclusion order from Seattle.
Yeah.
Or, 8-9 months in the King County Jail. On the top floor, King County Jail, before transfer to McNeil Island Federal Penitentiary, Gordon was a pacifist. He was a Quaker, and so his beliefs were both principled, and he later resisted the draft because of his pacifism. Mm-hmm. So he was both a conscientious objector and a draft resister.
Yeah,
I have to add parenthetically, what a tough interview Gordon Hirabayashi was, because he spoke very loftily and sincerely, but I never could get a soundbite out of him, and, a quote, a radio quote, a pithy quote for a radio broadcast, and so that's my memory of Gordon personally as a person.
He was heroic. So thank you for exposing me to that when I was 22. It really stuck with me following that.
And apparently I met Bob Hennessy, your husband, at the trial too. He was covering it for public radio.
It's all blurred. One thing I did want to ask you about,
you could have met Bob at the federal courthouse at the time, Lori, you missed your chance.
We waited a couple of years later.
Yeah,
we always made
it. It worked out.
That. Well, we actually, I don't know if you remember this, but when I worked at Cairo Radio, I also volunteered at KUOW because I was trying to get some time on air. And Bob was a reporter at KUOW. And I remember this kind of shy person who wouldn't talk to me. He remembers this arrogant person who was like, "This equipment's not as nice as the equipment that we have at Cairo."
That sounds like you, Lori.
And then we met like 3 years later in Capitol Hill, and the rest was history. So people always said that it was a little like when Harry met Sally. We had to have several chances.
I can see that.
Back to us. So I did want to ask you one more question. I know in the past you talked a little bit about your own childhood and your own childhood in terms of getting a sense about how your parents, how they responded, both in terms of some of the issues around their parents. And has that been a journey for you to kind of understand the way Americans responded to some of this treatment? And how were they with you and your work?
Well, my mother was in Japan at the time, so she's called what's it called a kibe nisei, born in San Jose and educated in Japan by circumstances of history. So she was stuck there during the war. My father was a kid, 16 maybe, evicted from Berryessa, a walnut farm in Berryessa, where he was a laborer, and sent to Heart Mountain, Wyoming. So, he didn't lose as much as older Nisei, and he was too young for the draft as well. So, he was not as bitter or angry as some of the other Nisei that I met here in Seattle, over the lost opportunities, the loss, or the actual losses of their homes, businesses, and farms. And for me, what it Well, so when my father talked about it, he talked about it as Heart Mountain, as camp, as and this is very common for my generation. It came off sounding like he went to summer camp, like church summer camp, And it wasn't until I opened one of his books that he had bought that I learned about the full extent of this event. So, but he did not have any law. Property losses to speak of. So that experience, my anger and commitment to this issue stems from the broader feel of the Japanese American community, and it's, I guess, it's one of disinheritance that because a whole generation of Nisei men and women were set back to zero after the war. They did. We did not. We do not have a generation of Nisei political leadership, economic leadership that the Germans and Italian Americans had after the war. There are a few isolated examples: Norm Mineta in San Jose, the Moriguchi family here with their Owajimaya. But not a broad sense of wealth that should that was lost during that period. But also I'm driven by a sense of just injustice. I mean, that it was a violation of due process and equal protection under the law. And this is what sustained me in doing the Day of Remembrance that we talked about earlier, which is around the time you met me. I used my press releases from the Day of Remembrance to get the job with Vic at as a desk assistant at Cairo. As my those are my writing samples. And then continuing on to report on it, the Gordon Hirabayashi's Coram Nobis trial. I did a film for PBS, Conscience of the Constitution, about the Heart Mountain draft resistors, and then a biography of the novelist John Okada, author of No No Boy, and now this graphic novel, We Hereby Refuse. So, I mean, that's kind of that has driven me all these 4 decades.
You know, what you just mentioned reminded me of, I don't know if you saw 13th, the documentary a couple of years
Absolutely, yeah.
ago.
Oh, yes, yeah.
There was a great moment in there when I think Van Jones said, what we essentially did because of the war on poverty, quote unquote, or I'm sorry, war on drugs, quote unquote, was remove a generation of leaders from their children's lives, re remove
Family
mentors,
separations, absolutely,
removing
and
men
lock
from
them
their
up in
sons.
cars, yes.
And that's, you just reminded me of that. And I had never seen that as the way of looking at what happened, but wow, that's very powerful to think about that.
The legacy of the redress campaign. I should mention that we did 10 years later, after the first Day of Remembrance, we succeeded. The baton being passed from group to group. President Reagan did in fact sign the Civil Liberties Act in 1988. 1988, 10 years later, to provide a token compensation of $20,000 per incarceree and a formal apology. I want to make sure that people understand that the compensation was not for property losses, but for strictly as a damage for the violations done by the to the Constitution by the government, mm-hmm. as damages.
Yeah.
And not, again, not for property losses. And again, for many Ise and Nise immigrants and children, the apology was much more important to them. Finally, to get the government to acknowledge that this happened, it was wrong, and they were sorry. The government was sorry. But my point being here that the legacy of this is the idea that it not happen again. And as we saw in the last 4 years, it did happen again.
Yeah.
We did have family separations. We did have targeting of immigrants, Muslim travel bans. And so the legacy is not only the how Japanese Americans, with the moral experience, having had this experience of wrongful incarceration based mm-hmm. solely on race, that it's become our we can speak about it with some moral authority,
yeah.
but also with that moral authority comes the moral obligation to stand with others who are targeted similarly yeah. on the basis of race, religion, or immigration status.
So that's
one part of legacy. And I'm seeing now the second part is to provide a precedent for, guess what, Black reparations,
mm-hmm.
That this has become a topic again. It was a topic 40 years ago, 35 years ago,
mm-hmm.
and now it's coming, circling back to the idea of H.R. 40, House Resolution mm-hmm. 40, to create a study commission to just look at the facts, look at the facts of American slavery, and look at the mm-hmm. facts of Reconstruction, and look at the facts of what can be done now to redress those injustices. The facts are different, of course, because slavery yeah. was contemplated in the Constitution. It was, mm-hmm. It was allowed. but nevertheless, a study of that by the government would, I think, be a good first step. And that precedent was set by the civil liberties, the wartime Commission on Wartime mm-hmm. Relocation and Internment of Civilians. Which we indirectly helped create with the Redress Campaign in 1981.
So actually, your title of your radio show, Other Voices, which you feel was probably marginalizing people at the time, is actually yeah. quite prescient to this larger theme of what we do to people when we feel, we being the white person,
yes.
feel scared or threatened of someone who's mm-hmm. other. There's a whole history of response that we see play out again and again.
Absolutely. And so these were the voices of the others, if I parse it that way.
Well, I want to give one more plug to the event. I'm going to include in the show notes places people can go to tune into that. Again, it's a virtual event, Saturday, February 19th, 4 p.m. And
moderated by Rita Brogan, Islander Rita.
I saw that. Rita. I love yeah. Rita. A neighbor. Well, I'm not right next door. Yeah, I've been to her house. An amazing cook.
Oh. Yeah, her and Michael. Yeah, I'll bet.
So yes, we will definitely share that so people can join you for that event. And then if they want to, apart from the event, if they want more information on your book, where do they go?
I have a blog, resistors.com, resistors with an E, and I have all my stuff up there.
All right. So now we're going to risk it. I've moved closer to my Wi-Fi. We're going to take yourself off video so we can say goodbye face to face.
Okay. Oh, if you insist. Okay.
I'm now back on my couch where I've spent the last 2 years. all right. Well, I just wanted to say from the bottom of my heart that I've always loved hearing about all the things you do, Frank, and we're just so very lucky to have you in the community. And I thank you for everything you've done.
You're very kind, Lori. And knowing you all these years has been one of the great privileges of my life. So
wow. I want to do this podcast again tomorrow.
Okay. You're on.
All right. Well, that's it for Washington Game Changers. And tune in next month. And we're going to be talking to someone who's done a lot for women's issues in the state. And that's my teaser. So stay tuned for more when we promote that. And in the meantime, if you have any questions about League of Education Voters, you can go to our website, educationvoters.org, and you can find me on Twitter or LinkedIn, and you can follow the podcast there as well. And Frank Abe, thanks again. It's great seeing you. This is great. Thanks.
As always, Laurie.